This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Because those of you listening today are probably interested in current events and governmental issues, you may be aware that President Bush will soon be giving his 2006 State of the Union address. However, plenty of our neighbors and co-workers won't know anything about it until their favorite TV shows are postponed because of it. So I'm here to present my State of the Union address when you're not expecting it. Mr. President, members of Congress, distinguished listeners, and fellow citizens, most of us are aware that our Statue of Liberty says, "Give me your poor, your tired, your huddled masses." But I believe we have been ignoring that for some time now. Possibly because when we began eating freedom fries, we began ignoring all other French items, including gifts from the French. Many citizens take the position that we can no longer accept immigrants, as our finances, our generosity, our personal lives are being too encroached upon. But I ask you, if we are looking out for our own citizens, how are we doing? If anyone bothered to ask, I believe the elderly, many of whom have had their medical benefits taken from them, would tell us, not very well. 6.4 million Medicaid beneficiaries lost their coverage on January 1st. The administration has responded with a PR campaign. The states with effort to make sure seniors are getting their medications. I'm sure the elderly are not happy with this health care resolution. Besides selling out our aged, our government is also selling its agenda. It doesn't matter whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, your attention can be bought, your votes influenced, all by meals, vacations, and the occasional campaign donation. Is this the state we want our union to be in? Currently, lawmakers are showing their willingness to invoke ethics into Washington, D.C., but they have failed to show us that their fingers are crossed behind their back. A rule to specifically ban meals and privately paid travel is being discussed, but members of Congress and their staffs could still travel the world on an interest group's expense and eat at the priciest restaurants on a lobbyist's account, as long as the lobbyist or group make a campaign donation when paying the bill. Isn't that what they're already doing? Our union is fast moving from a representative democracy closer to a theocracy. I recognize the connotation of the word, but while Christianity is often claimed as the religion which built our country and led our leaders into understanding the need for accepting all faiths, we are now becoming a form of government in which one religion or faith plays a dominant role, or a theocracy. Leaders want to make sure their personal beliefs are the major laws in effect. Homosexuals without any rights, physician-assisted suicide illegal, interests in internet pornography reported. Because although our legal tender says, "In God we trust," right on it, we don't really trust God to provide the punishment we can give if we know about these things we don't like. There's a little girl in Ashton, Nebraska, who wants to know what she can do to help save our country. Well, Emily, you can be more open-minded than your neighbors. Stop looking at every foreign individual as though they might be ready to plant a bomb somewhere. Let the gay folks get married if they want. Understand that others may have different beliefs than yourself, but that doesn't make you any better than them. Require your government leaders to do what you want, not what the big businesses want. Be proud of your country in a way that you would like to make it. And thank you for listening. Sunday morning. It's the 22nd of January. We are just motoring on through this time period. A very special guest today. Hopefully Stu and I can remember how to set up the everything properly. Let's see if I can do this right. Professor, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Oh, that is so nice. I'm always glad to hear your voice.
You're kind.
Because I think you are one of my more one of my more special guests. You've been deeply involved in your topic, in your specialty for so long, and you've been, you know, the wake up call here in Charlottesville, little 91.9. And I have a guest on who's been. You've been on CNN, right?
Yes.
You've been on a lot of the Washington, D.C. Sunday morning programs?
No, I've been on NewsHour. It goes a long way back. All kinds of networks.
Well, and I'm glad that, not only am I glad that someone of your knowledge lives here in Charlottesville and can help us locally, I'm particularly happy that you're here with me on Sunday morning.
I appreciate that.
Today's topic, for those of you tuning in, is going to be about the current events in Iran and a lot to do with the nuclear issues that are going on over there and the politics in general. Our guest is UVA Professor Emeritus R.K. Ramazani. Your specialty being politics and the Middle Eastern politics in particular, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, so write down the phone number, boys and girls, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, if you're maybe listening on the new Richmond 103.1 or down in Lynchburg over in the valley. Feel free to call us up in just a few minutes. Professor, let me ask you, just for those who may be tuning in, aren't familiar with you, how did you become a specialist in the Middle Eastern politics?
Well, I was actually trained in law, international law. I got my doctorate in international law at the University of Virginia Law School in 1954, and started actually teaching international law courses at UVA, but over time, because of my land of birth, so to speak, native home where I was born, Iran, I was inclined certainly to look at the Middle East and Iranian history and culture and politics. Increasingly, it became too difficult for me to teach both international law and Middle East politics. So I concentrated over a long period of time on teaching, studying, writing, publishing on the Middle East in general, but particularly on Iran and the Persian Gulf region.
Now, you were also involved, you were an advisor to President Carter during the U.S. hostage crisis back in
70? I had a meeting with President Carter, with others, at the White House, as I recall, December 10, 1979, soon after the hostage crisis, when the president was obviously getting advice from different people, experts, on how to get our American hostages released from captivity in Iran. Of course, the problem, agonizing problem, lasted for 444 days, which has had a kind of a burned a psychological scar in American mind. But of course, as we'll talk, we will see Iranians have their own psychological scar about what we have done to them.
Well, let's get started about the current events that are going on in Iran with the rest of the world that has brought this to be a topic on today's program. Iran is recently, I guess, reinstigated their uranium enrichment program.
Yeah, well, it is not really enrichment yet. There is what they call research program, nuclear research. But we in the West, especially in the United States, suspect that Iran ultimately is aiming at going nuclear, despite all the statements that have come out of Iran to the effect that they do want nuclear energy because of their growing need for electricity and other things that can be helped socially and economically develop the country. But there is a great deal of suspicion. Although the work of International Energy Agency so far has not come to the conclusion that there is a smoking gun, and that all the inspections that have been going on for years now have not yet reached a conclusion that Iran's program could be said for certain to go in the direction of enriching uranium at a high level, technically speaking, for production of nuclear bombs. Now, of course, in as a result of the breakdown of negotiations between the European three, that is Great Britain, France, and Germany, and Iran, which went on over more than 2 years, because of that breakdown and because of certainly our pressure on European countries, even on China and Russia, to come together, and there is an emergency meeting called for the 2nd of February in Vienna, so that International Energy Agency would consider the Iranian development, especially the resumption of nuclear research, as we see it, in defiance of the world public opinion. But Iranians have their own, so to speak, notion that they are not going to be pushed around, and they have already threatened to perhaps discontinue the permission for inspectors from IAEA to come to Iran. They have been doing it many, many times before. Let me ask you, Professor,
is there a particular, obviously it doesn't matter whether you're American or whether you're Iranian or anyone, everyone seems to have a fear in these days that it's difficult to have trust for someone else.
Exactly, and that is the key. In my opinion, from our perspective, of course, especially the United States and much of the Western world, our main drive is really to get Iran's nuclear program not to go in the direction of weaponizing nuclear energy. That is obvious. The point is very clear from our perspective. From the Iranian perspective, in my view, there is a long established mistrust of especially us. For what reason? Because if you go back in history, and history is always present in Iranian mind. It's a very old country, very old civilization, and it does remember its misfortunes. In 1953, CIA engineered a coup d'etat in Iran against a popularly elected, democratically oriented prime minister called Mossadegh. And when in Iran the revolution took place in 79, there was a firm belief that America, once again, is going probably try to plot the overthrow of the revolutionary regime, especially when we admitted the Shah for medical reasons to come to the United States. But the Iranians had a very difficult time to believe that because of their previous experience. Still believed that America has lost its bases in Iran, has lost its interest in Iran after 25 years under the Shah's regime, who was brought to the throne by us. Therefore, America is not prepared to recognize the revolution and is going to try to change that regime. Now, this has been there long before President Bush made statements about putting Iran in the axis of evil and also talking about regime change as a goal of American policy, foreign policy in the Middle East. And this have simply reaffirmed in Iranian mind that perhaps the eventual goal of the United States, Bush administration, is to get rid of this regime as they tried it in Iraq, you know. And therefore, this whole notion of nuclear, they say, why do you single us in the world? Japan is further ahead of us in nuclear energy. There are others well ahead of Iran in nuclear energy development, but you are singling us out, and perhaps that is why, again, as they see it, the nuclear question is used to pressure Iran and undermine this regime.
Well, that's a question that I think we lead into is, obviously, Americans, most of us would be concerned if Iran had the ability to make nuclear weapons, but what makes it okay for just a half dozen countries to have that ability?
Exactly. Well, you see, this is what they call double standards. Right next door, almost, is Israel. The world looked the other way, and they certainly, by everybody's assessment, Israel is a nuclear power. To the east of Iran, what I'm talking about is South Asia. You have Pakistan and you have India, both nuclear power. And so the way the Iranians look at it is that why you want to make a new law for Iran's case only? And everybody else, again, who is ahead of us, they say, whether it's Japan or any other country in nuclear energy development, you're not suspecting them, but you're suspecting us. You know, this is why they talk about hypocrisy on our part and double standards. We have our own view, of course. We hopefully are sincere about non-proliferation. Non-proliferation is an excellent goal for the world to embrace, because weapons are not, or nuclear weapons race is not going to be in the interest of international security and peace anywhere.
All right, we're going to take our first break, 11:19 here on the Wake Up Call with University of Virginia Professor Emeritus R.K. Ramazani, as we talk about Iran and the nuclear weapons. Please feel free to call in now that we've set a little background for you. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free number, 1-877-967-6762. Stu will grab the phone lines. While the professor hangs on for a second, let me tell you the markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Partly cloudy today, highs 40 to 45. A little rain tonight, lows 32 to 37. Rain tomorrow, highs 40 to 45. And there's clouds all across the listening area. In the valley, it's 40, 39 in Lynchburg, 42 in Richmond, and 39 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And we want to thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. The place to begin your enjoyment of winter outdoors. Blue Ridge has clothing and footwear for the season from Patagonia, Mountain Hardware, and the North Face. Good for keeping your head, hands, and feet warm on the trail or just walking around town. That's Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, Charlottesville, at Wintergreen, and in Richmond. Plus, you can also find them at brms.com. And WNRN reminds you that adult and youth program registration for students and members of UVA intramural recreational sports begins at sign-up night tomorrow, Monday the 23rd, from 5:30 until 7 p.m. at the Aquatic and Fitness Center Gym. You can register for adult and youth recreation instruction, outdoor recreation, and fitness programs. Or from 8 until 9, you can register for intramural sports leagues. Open registration then begins on Tuesday the 24th at the Aquatic and Fitness Center business office. Online info and registration forms are at the virginia.edu/IMS website. Or call the NRN studio line after the program today. All right, let's see what we got here. Let me put all these pages aside and get everybody fired back up. Professor, are you there?
Yes, sir.
All right, we have our first call today. We have Jenny from Charlottesville. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
Professor, can you hear Jenny?
I hope so.
All right, Jenny, go ahead.
I just wanted to comment that I think that our suspicion, I guess maybe the Western world, and why we single Iran and nuclear power out is because of the blatant anti-Americanism, blatant anti-Westernism, the violations against rights towards women in Iran, and just the whole closed society makes us suspicious in their intentions with nuclear power. If they were more open to democracy and had a more open society, I don't think that they would be treated or singled out as they are today. And that's just my comment. Thank
you. All right. Thanks for the call.
Yes. Well, you know, this is, again, a problem of perception. Sitting in Charlottesville, of course, we can imagine that that is why we don't want Iran to have nuclear energy. We are not talking about bombs. We are talking about nuclear energy. Iran is entitled to nuclear energy development, like any country that has signed nuclear non-proliferation treaty. All right? Article 4 of that treaty allows Iran, like any other signatory, to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. And this is what the Iranians claim to do. Now, why do we consider them? So I just try to explain. Because we just do not like this regime. But what we also have to think about is what about the mass of Iranian people? This is a country, large country, it's not Iraq. 70 million plus. And long history, about 2,500 years of history and culture. And this country's people are like an oasis of pro-democracy and pro-American feeling in the whole Middle East. But our media, by and large, has not brought this matter out. It is the people of Iran that matter, really. And any pressure on the regime is going to be counterproductive because all the moderate elements, pro-democracy elements, who want to see relations with America reestablished, they get alienated because they have a sense of national pride that why America singles out one country which has not yet been judged to have a smoking gun by the international community, not by us, not by the Iranians. But this is the problem. This is the complication that we have. It is not just factual. It is also perceptual. Now, there are many countries in the world that are not democratic. Why do we think that Iran is the one or Iraq is the one to be made democratic? Why don't we try to make democratic Egypt or Saudi Arabia or X number of countries, the ally and friend we have in Pakistan? That is a military dictatorship. It's not democratic. So this is again what gets us into the accusation by Middle Eastern public that we have double standards. We really don't care about who is democratic or not. What we really care about is who is with us or we think is against us. And that is the problem that we have to overcome. It is in our interest, in American interest, to understand the reasons of people's behavior elsewhere. We cannot just know about what we like, what we don't like. When we were number one enemy of the Soviet Union, and they were number one enemy of America, you know, we spent billions of dollars on Russian language, Slavic languages, think tanks, university professors, books, publications for decades to learn more about Russian culture and society, not because we liked them, because they were our enemies too, but because we thought we understand Russians better, it is in our interest. That is what I am hoping, have been hoping for 50 years plus in my teaching and writing, to see that we see our interest is interlocked with other people's interests. We have to be able to put ourselves in other people's shoes.
All right, let's take our next phone call. We are talking with University Professor Emeritus R.K. Ramazani about Iran and the current events regarding the nuclear weapons. Let me push all my buttons here, and we have Skyler from Virginia. Hi, Skyler.
Hey.
What's up? You're on the air, man.
Yeah, I had a question. Basically, what? I don't know if it's a question or a statement. The professor was talking about trying to find the reasoning behind our fear or whatever. And basically, he kept saying we. I think it's more like the president of the United States or Washington, that not really representing, like you hit on at the beginning of the show, saying they're not really representing what we as a people want. And I think that that's like continued now, because they're like Iran or whoever is saying that we, the whole Western world, are against them having power. Maybe it's just the president thinking that Iran is housing Al-Qaeda or something like that.
Well, I see where you're going with that, which is the president or the administration doesn't always represent the people's beliefs. But and I'm going to toss this to the professor, but I will say that whatever you believe happened in 2000, in 2004, 50%+ voted for President Bush. So thanks for calling. I'm going to let the professor get into that.
I wasn't really thinking about Iran at that time.
Well, that's probably true.
I mean.
But let's let the professor get into it. Thanks, man. All right, Professor, do you think that a lot of this has to do with the administration and their personal fears and beliefs rather than the average American?
Well, it's very difficult. Actually, on the Iraq case has become a litmus test, you know. Obviously, President Bush's popularity after 9/11, the tragic attacks on America, soared. But that popularity declined, has declined significantly. And the president's rating, if we are talking about public opinion, we are not talking about votes in the first election and second election. The popular opinion in America has declined in support of the administration's, first of all, what many have come to believe, that we were not really led rightly to believe what was going on in Iraq, in the sense that simply that there was no weapons of mass destruction, as was later on discovered in Iraq. Therefore, people say there was a deception. We were lied to by the administration and so on the Iraq situation, and therefore the public opinion is very divided in this country. There are those who certainly think that we should simply sooner or later withdraw from Iraq, and there are those who still believe that we had every right to go in there and overthrow Saddam Hussein because he was brutal and so on and so forth. Now, the public opinion here, therefore, is not united in terms of our Iraqi policy, nor, frankly, is the administration. We have different voices in the administration as to the extent to which Pentagon influenced policy, the extent to which the State Department influences policy. So it's we have a great deal of debate in our own country. And this debate, of course, is not going to be resolved by simply saying, well, if it were not for this administration, we wouldn't have all this problem. Maybe we would still have some of these problems.
Stewart's answering a phone call, so let me take this moment to thank Five Guys Burgers and Fries for their support today. They are the reader's choice for burgers and rated by Zagat Restaurant Survey for 4 years running. Five Guys serves America's standard, fresh and handmade from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and they're open until 10 on Fridays and Saturdays. Five Guys Burgers and Fries behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center and coming soon to the Hollymead Town Center and the Downtown Mall, Charlottesville. 975 Guys. All right, let's see. We have Ted from Charlottesville. Hey, Ted.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well.
I have enjoyed listening to the professor's positions on this because I kind of believe, and I've traveled a little bit in the world, and I feel that there are people, I mean, people are people everywhere I've gone is what I've really noticed. If you can just get out and sit in the cafes and have a drink with somebody, you find that no matter where you go, what country they're from, they're just like everybody else. They're trying to raise families and have jobs and, you know, stay alive and enjoy their lives, whatever their beliefs might be. And I think that what we've got is a distrust based on a distrust of the extremist Islam that is portrayed to us in this country, that we have these zealots that truly do not see any kind of reason. They believe we're evil and they'll do anything they can to destroy us as the great Satan, as they used to say back in the hostage crisis. And I see that also because I see the leaders in our country and a large percentage of our country as being equally religiously blinded. And there's just this distrust. These two religions have been, the Christian religion, these two religions have been fighting each other for centuries. And I think that it's a continuation of the exact same problem. And that the intellectuals and the people who want to see people as people, and, you know, who think about things rather than just believe things, are being shut out of the argument. And that's really, to me, what the crux of the problem is. There's a distrust of Iran having nuclear weapons because we're like, oh my God, the first thing they're going to do as soon as they have a missile is blow us up with it. And there's no understanding. There's a fear in this country of nuclear energy. Anyway, people don't like it as an energy. All they can think about is glowing babies and things like that. That's sort of rambling, but that's my point. Thank you.
Hey, good call, Ted. Professor?
Yes, sir.
Your reply, I think, I'm not sure this is exactly what Ted was getting into, but do you think that democracy and the Muslim faith are incompatible?
This is a question which in the Muslim world has traces back to almost 200 years ago. When the Middle East was, so to speak, exposed to Western ideas and institutions, the ideas of democracy, liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, all these things, you know, were very new in the 19th century coming to the Middle East. Therefore, in that kind of a context, there has been a major, major development within the Muslim world. And when we say the Muslim world, by the way, I want to make very clear, there is no such thing as monolithic Islam. There is no such thing. There are more than 50 Muslim countries, and there are stretching from Morocco to Indonesia. They all have different languages, different cultures, different habits, different histories, different attitudes in politics and so on. So nevertheless, if we take the total, there is at the intellectual level two schools of thought. One is that there is nothing in Islam in its terms of its doctrine, fundamentals, that is incompatible with Islam, with democracy. There is another school of thought in terms of the fringes within the Muslim world, the extremists, that certainly think that their way is the better way, and there is really no way of reconciling with democracy, because a lot of these extremists associate democracy with their experience with colonialism and imperialism. The whole Middle East, in terms of the French, especially the British, in the past, you know, they are, therefore, when we talk about democracy, we know what we're talking about. But they don't hear it that way. They hear it that this is something which is bought by the West as another means to enslave them, to suppress them, to bully them, you know. And here again, we have a problem of misperception, misunderstanding. But by and large, the mainstream Muslim thought is there is no difficulty in conciliation between Islam and Western democracy. And that is, I believe, is the real dominant thinking. But when you get to a man like bin Laden, who invokes Islam, he is really misinterpreting his own religion, in the sense that he makes it a religion of war and violence and so forth. And yet again, when you look at him, what he complains about is not so much in terms of our Christianity or democracy or anything here. They talk about what they think we have done to them in history, like having troops in Saudi Arabia, the Holy Land, and going and invading Iraq, and so on. So they take all this to be the driving force by the West, by America, rather than seeing democracy in the way we tend to see, that it is indeed liberty is fundamental to democracy, no matter for whom. From Thomas Jefferson to the present, we have a nation, we as a nation in America, we have believed that liberty is not just for Americans, that is good for everybody. But the point is how you go about spreading liberty. And when it becomes joined with force and invasion, then it is not seen the way it should be seen. And that is the problem we face, and that's the problem they face. But I hope I have made it clear that the mainstream, the overwhelming majority of the Muslim, they also want to have better life, more security. They want to have more liberty, more freedom. It is a universal aspiration. But in every society, whether Muslim, Christian, Jewish, you have extremists. And extremists should never be used as depiction for an entire Muslim society or entire religion or entire region of the world.
All right, 11:40 here on the Wake Up Call, about to take our second break. We are talking with University of Professor of Politics R.K. Ramazani about Iran and the current events regarding nuclear weapons. Please feel free to dial us up. Stu is out there answering the phone today and passing you through 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free number if you're a little further away, 1-877-967-6762.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, is Interstate 81 going to become a 12-lane monster with tolls possibly sending tractor trailers more onto Route 29? Did you know that Hollywood is going to visit Crozet to film the sequel to Bruce Almighty? And a local librarian recently helped pick the most distinguished picture book of the year. She's in FaceTime. The Hook, important information enclosed. Please read now. And additional support today coming from 45fix.com. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate no-obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And let me take a moment to thank Pamela Peterson, Susanna Spencer, and Ruth Stone for their generous support during our fall fund drive. It's because of people like them, as well as program underwriters like Pizza Bella and Starlight Express, that you have a program such as the Wake Up Call. So stay tuned, tell a friend, and get ready to support the Wake Up Call and NRN in the next fund drive this spring. All right. Put the professor back up. Professor, you were talking about extremists a little bit there.
Yes.
Well, you know, and we've talked a lot about fear,
yes,
as being a part of this, but, you know, it seems to me that we have a Muslim country who would have the potential for weapons of mass destruction, led by a man who hates America and defying the United Nations, and who seems to be an extremist. So should we give them the possibility of enriched uranium, you know, and then maybe end up having to do the same thing with our administration, solving the problem the same way they have with Iraq?
No, first of all, there are so many questions in that one statement. The Iranian regime, obviously, the sense of distrust, as I tried to explain, is widespread and has historical roots, and it cuts both ways. We have our own reasons for mistrust, they have their own reasons. And the way to overcome is to bridge and engage and talk rather than try to make threats. And we have actually been at loggerheads with Iran for 79 to the present, more than quarter of a century. We have imposed embargoes on them. We have frozen their assets, which have stayed at the time of the hostage crisis, you know. And we broke diplomatic relations. We pressured other countries to so-called contain them and pressure them and bully them. It never worked, and it will not work. The thing to do with Iran is to engage, because not engaging Iran is not simply hurting the regime. It's hurting a moderate, a rational, a decent, reasonable people in that country. They rally against the hawks in Iranian regime. Now, that is the thing. Now, as to what we should do, again, we are committed, like the Iranians are, on the non-proliferation treaty, not to see the spread of nuclear weapon. And Iranians say, we do not want nuclear weapon. We want nuclear energy for economic, social purposes. We don't believe it, and there we are. We are, this time, again, we are back to the problem of mutual mistrust. This is the simple issue. Contradictory said, we do not trust Iran, you know. And when you start from that premise, you can't really get very far. The point is to use the system we have. We have an international monitoring agency, all right? And that agency has been going in and out of Iran for more than 2 years. They say no smoking gun yet. We have to go by that. We cannot really, as the chief of the international agency, the director of it, Al-Baradi, said, Mohammed Al-Baradi, he said, when he was in Israel, I believe, he said, we cannot read intentions. We are not God. We can only monitor facts. And so far, we have not found anything to say that Iran is going nuclear. But this is, again, yet to be established. And that is why we have this system. That is the way to go. In other words, non-proliferation is the goal, should be not only of Iran, but America, and everybody who has been a signatory to that treaty. Our problem is existential. Our problem is that what about those countries that are way ahead of Iran in nuclear energy development, and we don't say anything against them? Now, this is at the international level difficult for people to accept, because the developing countries say, all right, if you make a new law for Iran because you don't like it, that country today, tomorrow you will make a law for us because you don't like us. What we have to do is to stick to international established standards. And that international established standard is non-proliferation of nuclear weapon anywhere. In my humble view, the best thing that can happen to the whole Middle East is denuclearization. Anybody, including Israel, not to have nuclear weapon, whether it's Israel, whether it's India, whether it's Pakistan, and so on. But when we look the other way about one country, then it becomes that people start suspecting our sincerity. Are we really for non-proliferation, or are we selective? And we say we are for non-proliferation if we don't like somebody. We are for proliferation if we like somebody. Now, this is a major problem. If we can maintain an objective standards that regardless of whom we like or don't like, we cannot any longer in this world afford people to go nuclear. And we have got to stand with that principle, non-proliferation. Therefore, no, my answer to the question is, should we allow Iran? No, the international community should not allow Iran to go nuclear.
All right, let's take our next phone call. We have Vanessa. Hey, Vanessa.
Hi.
Fire away.
Well, I just wanted to thank you, Rick, and also the professor for having a show on this topic. I found it to be very upsetting to listen to the news and also to hear some of the comments the callers have made. While I think they're good intentioned, I just want to say I really agree with what Professor has to say, that we can't afford to be hypocritical in terms of nuclear proliferation, and that I hope that we can find a way to work with Iran. And again, just to thank you all, I just want to say that I like to hear a reasoned viewpoint, and I hope that that this country will start going in the right direction, even though it doesn't seem like it is right now.
Well, somebody has to step forward and put their hand out first.
Yep.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
I appreciate the comment.
Don't forget, you can hear this program if you joined us late. I don't know what you were doing instead. Or if you want to hear it again, www.cvillepodcast.com. And Sean Tubbs runs a nice site. Please feel free to check it out and listen to our show from start to finish. Oh, I had something I was going to do. Oh, I was going to read this. I want to thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support today. Blue Ridge Graphics, Mead Avenue at East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. Please feel free to dial us up. It is 1151 here on WNRN, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, as we talk with Professor R.K. Ramazani, Middle Eastern specialist politics, and we discuss Iran and the nuclear weapons issues. Professor, let me ask you, from a lot of the things that I've read or heard, whether, you know, news or radio, et cetera, is that the possibility or the probability is that economic sanctions will be imposed if Iran continues their research. I'm curious, though, as to how that might hurt Iran and how it really might end up hurting the United States.
Well, it will hurt the world. The reason is very obvious. You see, sanctions on Iran, to be effective is what we cannot do. If we want it to be effective, the only sanction can really hurt Iran, the backbone of its economy, is to have oil embargo. President Carter, in 1979, established oil embargo. Later on, President Reagan further developed oil embargo. But oil situation in the world today is such that you and I are feeling the brunt of it in terms of the gas price we carry. To deprive the world of 4 million barrels of Iranian oil is incomprehensible. In other words, certainly Iran cannot afford being deprived of exporting its oil, but still, it can do it for enough time to wreak chaos in world economy, not just Iranian, not just American. So our options are really limited, militarily limited, because Iran is in Iraq. Iran has a widespread nuclear facilities. We can hit or strike militarily 1 or 2 or 10, but still we would not be able to cripple the nuclear facilities of Iran. And the only rational way that can be done is to, in this is my opinion, of course, I think the only thing that I can see that could possibly be appealing to the Iranians is the Russian proposal that nuclear energy Iran develops up to a point. When it comes to the enrichment of it, it would be done on the Russian soil. This is the Russian proposal, and we have agreed with it. The only problem with us is, and with the Russians as well, is that it is not clear how serious they are, as the Russians, how serious we are. I would suggest that the best way to do it is Because, and the reason for that is Russia is Iran's leading energy partner. It has a great deal of influence with Iran. Iranians do not mistrust them at this point in history the way they distrust the West or was. If we stand behind the Russians, and the Russians really get out of the sideline, and we get out of the sideline, and in practice support this proposal, I think there is a way of resolving this with negotiated settlement.
All right, 11:55 here in the wake-up call. We are finishing up the program. We have 5 minutes left. You are listening to 91.9 WNRN Charlottesville and 89.9 WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. I do want to invite you to hang around because at noon, George Bell will be here for Les Temps Perdue. He plays the best of 80s and 90s alternative. He doesn't play Chaka Khan, Led Zeppelin, or Styx, which is pretty much all my discs from the 80s, but you will hear the Cardigans, Talking Heads, and Roxy Music, and requests are always welcome. Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. Stay tuned. All right, Professor. trying to find the question that I had all set up for you. We were talking about the potential of embargoing Iran and how that would hurt the entire world, but is there a possibility? I read some notes where Iran has most likely begun transferring their oil assets from Europe to Southeast Asia.
There was a rumor that Iranians were going to transfer their bank assets from European banks to Asia, but today, in the New York Times, there was a denial of that move by Iranians. The reason people rumored this was that something was said by a second-ranking officials in Iran, but more especially because they think Iranians got quite hurt during the hostage crisis when we froze their assets, you know, and especially the ones in the United States. And then there was a major dispute as to whether or not the American subsidiaries in Europe that had Iranian assets could be also frozen. So this is denied. The Iranians don't believe that we're going to try to freeze their asset. That is a long way off, and that there is a way finally to negotiate. You know, one of the striking lessons of the Iranian hostage crisis is we did all the things we could do. We went to the UN Security Council, got Iran condemned. We went to the International Court of Justice. Iran was condemned. We went and embargoed Iran oil-wise, froze their assets, broke diplomatic relations. None of this worked until there was an indirect channel of mediation and negotiation. And finally, it ended up with Algerian mediation, and therefore we came to have Algiers Agreement of 1981. So the way to do it is to negotiate with Iran. I do not believe that the force and pressure alone, it is okay. Okay, diplomacy, we always say, would have to have behind it some kind of a power of coercion. But the point is, this is not the time to talk about coercive measures. This is the time still to talk about negotiations through the multilateral channels, the UN be it, the International Energy Agency, Atomic Energy Agency, or the mediation, maybe South African mediation, maybe the Russians who are now setting a proposal. We have to exhaust, as Senator McCain said, we have to exhaust peaceful approach. This was not his word, but he meant we have to exhaust what we can do through negotiations. The use of force should be the last resort.
Well, Professor, I hope that you... I would like to see that you get to participate in this, because obviously your kindness and your reasonability would be important in making things come to a productive end.
I hope so. This is the, should be everybody's hope, that we can do things without another war and another violence. We have had enough of that.
All right, time for us to end. I thank you for coming on, Professor.
Not at all.
If you'll hang on to the phone.
I appreciate you having me.
Stay on for a moment. I'll get Stuart to get your address, and I will make you a copy of the tape, as I promised.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Next week, we will have a few guests on as we talk about green homes and a local school that's being built in the green sense, as environmentally talking. Thanks, folks. Next up, George.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.rlc.net. The wake-up call is produced by Catherine Greiner. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.